Hello, I'm Tim Worthington and welcome to a new series of podcasts called The Golden Age of Children's TV, tying in with my new book, The Golden Age of Children's TV, available now in all good bookshops, the story of children's television from Play School and Pipkins to Pops Programme and Press Gang and everything in between. This is, of course, the theme from Top Cat, or to be more accurate, if you're watching it on the BBC, Boss Cat, which I describe in The Golden Age of Children's TV as Hanna-Barbera's Feline Scam Festival. There's plenty that I have to say about children's television in the book itself, though, so for these shows, I thought I'd ask a selection of fun guests what their favourite children's television programme is and why. So before we go on for so long that we reach that jump cut where they had to remove the words Top Cat, can you guess who is in it today? Pulling up Orm's floorboards is writer, artist and abominatrix Juliet Brando. So Juliet, what is Orm and Cheap and why do you love it so much?
It was a programme from when I was very, very, very small, and it's about a little baby bird and its best friend who's a worm, and I hated them. I loved the programme, but I hated them. I was always, always rooting for their natural predators. There was a crow and a cat and I think a rat. I don't remember a lot of details, but I didn't know what a crow was called in those days. And so even though they probably said it in the programme, I named it Enemy Bird. And I was sort of Enemy Bird's biggest fan. And after one episode, I spent hours just drawing and cutting out not only a picture of Enemy Bird, but I made little paper models of all Enemy Bird's Enemy Bird friends, and basically, yeah, just made probably about 30 to 40 little models of different Enemy Bird characters that could a big dangerous flock to gag up on Orm and Cheap. I was very disappointed that no episode ever ended with them being brutally murdered by any of their predators.
Well, yes, they were puppets designed by Mary Edwards, who also made Crow from Saturday Superstore. And once you know that, you cannot unsee the familiar relationship between them, I don't think. But my main memory of it, because I was a little bit over it by the time it was on, was thinking it just looked weird, because it was all very pastel pink and violet and feathery and shot in real soft focus as well, with these odd sort of oversized hand puppets with very sort of eyes that seem to look straight through you.
Yeah, it had a sort of eerie atmosphere. There was something slightly folk horror about it. It had a kind of, I don't know, you know, like one of those music videos from the 70s where people had long hair and sort of were out in the countryside being a little bit witchy or a little bit pagan. It had that kind of eerie energy to it, the sort of very strange, I don't know, just sort of slightly otherworldly, something slightly unnerving, I think, to a tiny child. But I think maybe that's also why I liked it, because, you know, there was always this undertone of peril.
Well, what made it weirder still was it was narrated by Richard Briers, who I would imagine they brought in, you know, to give a sort of a funcular, reassuring tone. But he just somehow made it weirder still, because in his voice, my recollection is it's all delivered in rhyming couplets, the dialogue and his narration. And so it just felt even more odd and angular and stilted in a very strange way.
Yeah, again, it was sort of this weird, unnerving vibe about it. And, you know, that's the thing I remember most, like a kind of one of those dreams that is very nearly slipping into a nightmare. And I guess that's sort of also why I, you know, even though I knew logically that they probably wouldn't actually kill off Orm or Cheap, there was always just this slight underlying feeling that they might. You know, they might, you know, a bit like that character in episode 2 of Spooks, where, you know, sort of killing off a main character in a shocking and gory way. There was just, yeah, always just this slight sense that something really, really dark might happen. And it was dark. It felt dark. you know, I think that's why I was into it.
And they were both very twee characters. And, well, they would have to have been twee to inspire a rat, a cat and a crow to all work together. Put aside the fact that they could just have picked on and consumed each other to work together to, you know, I don't know, there must have been something about it, because I remember Smash Hits once in their next issue thing did a sort of parody of the week's TV, you know, and they did spoof listings for Take the High Road song, but it had Orb and Chief and said, the Puppet Pals plan a gruesome murder. And that can't have not been, you know, that isn't just like odd juxtaposition. That is somebody who was disturbed by this programme and convinced of it.
And it, again, it sort of doesn't sound entirely out of the realms of possibility. It's, you know, there's something so kind of slightly off about it. I mean, also logically, I'm not sure if this was ever addressed, but if Cheep was a bird who'd fallen out of a nest and couldn't fly and wasn't eating a worm or a snail or, you know, any of the other small friends that were around him, what was he eating?
Well, that does bring me round to, I think, in a very odd way, what made the biggest impression on me about it at the time was that the theme song is a very sappy synth ballad with Cheep singing, if only I could fly, if only I could fly, then I a proper bird would be. So he's not a proper bird at the moment. I think there was a variant sometimes where Orm said, if only I could sing, because, you know, as we all know, worms sing. But what is really weird is I remember at the time, it was around the time I first sort of seriously started listening to David Bowie, because, you know, that was when all the albums got reissued and I had elder siblings who liked him and so on. So I had recently heard Low, and I remember thinking, that sounds like Art Decade, but nicer. Again, you can't unhear that once you had that link. But a couple of years later, out comes There She Goes by The Lars. What is the main guitar riff in that if it's not, if only Cheep could fly?
Oh, he's
that
everywhere.
That is a direct lift.
Yeah.
That song is not about heroin. It's about this creepy bird.
But also, I mean, wasn't it around the same time as Orville was, you know, singing about a very similar situation?
These two made Orville look like he had a subscription to Loaded.
But, you know, they had a lot in common. But, you know, I think probably Orville would have eaten the worm.
What would Keith Harris have had to say about that?
But yeah, it's just such a sort of, I mean, on the face of it, it's quite a sort of cute concept for a show. And, you know, I mean, the bird would be the worm's natural predator and they've risen above that. And clearly Cheep throughout the two series that were made was slowly starving to death. So yeah, it's, I don't know, it just had this slight kind of uncanny vibe to it that just, you know, it was just like there was something just really dark and sort of slightly unnerving under the surface of it, you know, just something really off.
Well, there was a lot of kind of puppet folk tailory around in children's television in that time slot, particularly on ITV in the 80s. And I'm not 100% sure why that was. It seemed to just suddenly come back in from nowhere.
And I suppose with the kind of the influx of, you know, American cartoons that were sort of very big and bombastic and lots of hype. And I suppose at that time, the kind of, you know, Reagan administration, just sort of everything was very American and brash and showy, and it's almost like it was sort of the opposite of that, this sort of strange sort of local backlash, you know, a kind of something that was so very, very British and kind of, you know, something kind of quite twee and comforting and almost sort of, you know, low key in comparison.
What would have happened though if they had both achieved at the same time their heartfelt desire to fly and sing respectively? Could they have teamed up with Orm on Cheep's back and sort of taken on their adversaries?
What, as a sort of like flying, singing mass of noise?
Yes.
Just now I'm just imagining, you know, the crow and the cat and the rat just going, oh, for fuck's sake. It's like, because it's a bit like, because, you know, I was, you know, because I don't leave them on their own together, but having a small parrot and a cat in the same house last year when I was having windows and doors replaced. Winter, the little cat, she was still quite new at that time, and she's a very nervous girl anyway, because, you know, former feral. And while the builders were in, I had to take both the animals downstairs, and they were hiding in the basement. But Winter, she was on my bed, and then Digby was on my shoulder. But as I was walking down the stairs, he decided in true Digby fashion to be a total dick about it and just fly around and go mad. And I was worried about what Winter would do, because, you know, she's a natural predator, and as a kind of a cat who'd formerly been feral, she'd probably eaten quite a few birds. But her first reaction was like, oh shit, it can fly. And she went and hid under the bedclothes. she fully crawled under the quilt and hid until I'd put Digby in a cage.
Now, are you telling me that wouldn't be a great episode of Ormond Cheap?
Well, yeah, now I'm picturing, you know, the sort of flying, weird kind of, I don't know, sort of this sort of composite Orm Cheap flying, singing monster creature. And yeah, the cat just going, oh, shit. Yeah, because I imagine, you know, if he hadn't have starved to death, Cheap would have grown. I don't know what kind of bird he was supposed to be, but, you know, he could
not
be a really
proper
massive
one.
Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, he could grow up to be something massive, like a fucking heron or something. And, you know, he's only that small because he's just really malnourished, because he's not eating a worm. But yeah, if he ate all the other worms and snails and, you know, all his friends, you know, he might grow up to be absolutely massive.
Okay, so Juliet, I'm plugging the Golden Age of Children's TV. Is there anything you want to promote, or that Digby wants to promote as well?
Just if anybody's got any TV writing work, always punt it my way. And Digby says, meh. Any words from you, little Winter? My cat. Winter, any words? Oh, she says,
joining me on the Who Do We Want? We Want Scruffy, When Do We Want Him Now March is writer and podcaster John Rain. So John, why is Grange Hill and why do you love it so much?
Grange Hill was an excellent Phil Redmond drama I became addicted to as a kid, because it felt like some sort of utopia, especially when I was at junior school, that one day I would be able to age into this wonderful school where there's hijinks aplenty and fun. And then when I eventually did reach the age to enter such a utopia, I found that it had lied to me. But I loved it all the same. I came to love everybody in it like a brother.
Well, what would you say was your era in particular? Or did you have more than one?
No, my era was solidly, it was basically for the entire run of Gonch. In fact, Gonch is the consistent all the way through. So it's Gonch and then Ziggy, Robbie, and Gonch as a trio later on, and with Maul and McCall at the end and Mr. Robson as the gym teacher. Yeah, that whole sweet area. When Ziggy finally left, that's when I lost interest, because the dynamic was so good. And then when Ziggy left, it went, because there's a horrible thing about Grange Hill, that when you reach the sixth form, you might as well be dead to the show, because you just have no interesting qualities anymore, apart from that you wear jeans. That's it. You just sit round in a common room going, oh, I think we should have our own radio station. Why don't we set one up? We're not allowed. It's just really dull. Whereas everybody else is running around in school uniforms and having a nice time. So yeah, when Ziggy left, that's pretty much when I checked out. I mean, I'd occasionally dip in, but I was a solid fan for the whole Ziggy Gonch era.
Well, that's interesting you say that, because I found that most people, when they recall Grange Hill, I mean, obviously I do remember the hard-hitting moments, you know, the shock endings and, you know, people falling off walls and so on. But I always felt that was only half the story. And the other half was, obviously, either side, you know, you got people like Pogo Patterson fulfilled this role. But when you had gone to his associates, and there'd be an episode ending where, you know, one of them would become a financial cropper, or someone would just fall over or whatever, and then you get the do-do-do-do. There was this whole comic element that really has been a bit, I would say, overshadowed by people's memories of the hard-hitting content.
Yeah, I mean, it was a classic example of what you're saying there, because they learned their lesson, because there was a kid, I can't remember his name now, who drowned in the pool.
Oh, Jeremy Irving, yeah.
Yeah, was it Jeremy? And then at the end, over the credits, but for some reason they just used the normal Grinch Hill theme. So it had this jaunty with a corpse being brought out of a child. And obviously they learned the lesson there, because when Danny Kendall passed away, they brought in the somber music at the end. They didn't use the theme, because Danny Kendall was a beloved James Dean of Grange Hill, and his death, you know, was marked with a tree being planted.
He was not beloved by me.
No? No, he was a dick. I hated him. But the only thing I want to know, people often say, when we talk about it, people say, what did he die of? And I'm not sure, but I always wanted to know the bigger mystery. What was in the red carrier bag in his suit pocket?
I don't think I've ever seen that speculated on, to be honest.
He always had a red little carrier bag poking out of his pocket, his blazer pocket. I always assumed it was glue, because I saw a boy once at a train station sniffing glue with a bag. So I thought, oh, Kendall's a glue sniffer, and that's why he died. But we'll never know how Danny Kendall died, or if he was murdered. We'll never know. We just know that he is dead, and it was important.
I mean, surely he wasn't murdered by Mr. Bronson. He is many things, but I do not think he is a cold-blooded killer.
No, you wouldn't murder someone then leave him in your own car. Bronson's cleverer than that. He'd put him in the pool, or pin him to the mosaic he was making. Sort of Silence of the Lambs style.
Do you remember, though, as you were such an ardent fan of Gonch and Company, now, I've never encountered anyone else who remembers this. Do you remember the walled-up ghost hoax that they perpetrated on Trevor Cleaver?
Yes, they had like a little basement area they were able to go and have lunch in, and Cleaver was being a pain in the arse at the time, so they mocked up. They had Vince tell him that it was haunted, and they all hid in there. When he went down there, they all made noises and he ran away. I'm scared.
Well, Gonch and Ziggy dressed up as sort of steampunk Ghostbusters.
They did.
With, you know, those big sort of orange ear coverings that people using pneumatic drills used to use?
Yeah, that's right.
And also, Hollow had to go behind the wall with the green torch to pose as the ghost. He pointed out that Robbie was actually smaller than him. Mm. And Robbie said, too late, mate.
Hollow was a sort of oft-forgotten hero. He was there. He was sort of the lubricant to get Gonch into the show by giving him a double act. And then when it became clear that Gonch was more powerful than he could ever imagine, they got rid of him quite quickly. And then once you put Gonch together with Robbie and Ziggy, my God, it were magic.
And contrasting that at the time, you did have the melodrama of Aunt Jones, the real accidental school rebel, who apparently rebelled by being a bit of a just 17 level hunk.
He did.
That was how he rubbed the authorities up the wrong way, was by having very elaborate hair.
And also, he was one of those characters that was always like, get off my back! All the time. And he thought that Bronson had it in for him. And he eventually got expelled, didn't he? Or did he leave the school? One of the
two. He left to go to St. Joe's, I think.
That's
right. Which is one of the ever-evolving other schools.
But he came back later on with the canal trip. They thought it was some sort of crim, but it was him sneaking back to see everyone.
He was a stowaway, yes. They discovered it because Freddie Mannering, didn't he, like, turn some gas on from
yes.
And he lay down with his Walkman on, no doubt listening to Climby Fisher or
definitely
similar, and Ant discovered him and burst in saying, it's Freddy. I think while that, who was it? Was it Mr. Scott, the teacher with the guitar? It was a bit of a young goody two-shoes.
Yeah, I can't remember his name, but yeah, it was him.
The other thing I remember about the canal trip was because Freddie Mannering, obviously, again, he's a character who's mainly been forgotten, but he was sort of the fashion victim.
Oh my God, wasn't
he? Of that intake with his... He had kind of the alarm-style hair. Yeah. Even more alarming, well, literally, than Imelda had. And he always wore those kind of, those weird camouflage print, odd-coloured, Weller Shockwaves pattern tops.
Mm. And the suit jackets that are pulled up to the elbows.
The whole canal boat trip was a procession of him falling into puddles of mud and ruining his clothes.
Yeah.
And it ended with him having to wear, as one of the teachers put it, an Aran sweater and wellies. So they didn't have time to do a second take. Somebody said wellies instead of belly.
Nice. Freddie was in... important because he didn't really have a lot to do, like you say, he was just like a clothes horse. But then his sister Chrissy, she then had the important storyline later on of teen pregnancies.
Yeah, I kind of tuned out by then. It got a little too, I don't know, it was when they changed the theme music
in 1988, and the opening, to be fair, they had actually changed the opening title before that and done a different arrangement of the original theme, which didn't work.
Yeah.
But it was that makeover, as I called it, the Brother Beyond music years, that it just did, it wasn't the same programme anymore. And it was trying to, I don't know, I think there's really something in what you said very early on, is that it did feel like these characters were being presented as if they could be your friends.
Yeah.
I'm sure a lot of people actually wanted to go to Grange Hill, whereas it was like you were being talked down to by the characters afterwards.
Yeah, there was a lot of issues. Obviously, they became very famous for the big issue of Zamo's downfall, which got them into the White House, of all places. Imagine that. Imagine watching Grange Hill in 1978 and going, they're going to end up in the White House in Washington, you know, singing a song about drugs. But they did.
Yeah, and there's that whole, I mean, I've never got to the bottom of, when they did Just Say No, the single, it was launched on Blue Peter, I think ahead of the actual Zamo storyline. But I distinctly remember, and I'm not the only person who remembers this, Janet Ellis saying, and the B-side features a rap by Maluki. As in Maluki Christie played Kevin Balon.
Nice.
There was no rap by him on the B-side. And I've written two books about BBC records and tapes. I've never got to the bottom of what happened there. I want to hear his rap about Just Saying No. He does a small rap in the middle. Where he goes, after all you did to me, you expected me to shake your hand. No, no. But that was all we got.
We should have had a B-side, a tender ballad by Roland about how his alarm clock was stolen and sold for heroin.
It did give us that classic scene, though, where he turned up late for the French oral. Mr. Bronson said, where have you been, Browning? He said, my alarm clock had gone. I said, oh, what do you mean, Browning? Was your alarm clock gone off? No, sir, it had gone. And Bronson did a confused face.
Because he was lording, he was holding Roland up as a prime ideal French student, wasn't he? Bronson for once, Bronson was behind a student and saying, he is great. And he lets him down with the oral exam because the examiner, I think he'd already left or was about to leave.
I think he was halfway through the door. Yeah, where did you stand on Roland, though?
I didn't like Roland. I thought he was a bit annoying.
Did you not like it when he cheated in the school competition to collect Minto Bar wrappers? And they won a visit to the school for Miss Minto.
He was all right. He was always sort of like on the outside, wasn't he? Mind you, I never really chimed with Zamo and everybody either. It was only when the next era came in that I really kind of, I was like, ah, this is my comfortable space of people. Whereas everybody else, they all sort of felt like my brother's lot. And I never felt at home with them. I mean, one of the earliest ones I remember watching was the one with the French exchange student crashes the car.
Oh, yes, with those two.
The girls.
Two sort of tearaway girls.
Mm.
And I just remember the French exchange students would go, faster, faster, in a very sort of, this bloke isn't really French, is he, way.
No, absolutely not, no. And he was called like Jean-Philippe or something. Slow down, Jean-Philippe. That's the sort of earliest time I remember watching it. And there wasn't really anyone to cling to for me at a young age. But then when Robbie came in quite early, because he was Zamo's girlfriend's little brother, and then I was like, oh, OK, I can sort of vibe with this guy because he's, I mean, less said about that now, the better. But I could certainly, he was the first sort of person I could barnacle to and just go, oh, OK, these are my people, these are my age group. Because Zamo, when I was a little kid, looked like he was 50.
Yes, he always did have that sort of, it was very odd, a slightly older look about him. And I remember I had the Grange Hill annual where I have photos of the cast as very young children. And he looked old even in that.
I just never vibed with Zamo because he always felt like he was much older than me.
Who was your bully, though? Not actually who bullied you in school, but who was your Grange Hill bully?
Well, I got the tail end of Gripper, where Baxter tells him off. But I suppose the big one was Maula McCall. But before that, also the girl...
Imelda. God, you Imelda, see, I thought you could say Imelda.
Yeah, sorry, I forgot. Imelda. Yeah, because her of the putting the fiberglass down people's backs and everything. And abusing Harriet the donkey. Yeah, Imelda, definitely Imelda, because I remember her, Ziggy, pushing her into the pond in like her first episode, I think. But yeah, then Maula. I thought Maula was just quite funny, because it was like, we've got Gripper at home type thing. And they had the gridiron gang, which were just quite pathetic, really. Just running around. Because American football was quite big at the time, wasn't it? So they were kind of trying to cash in on that.
And also, didn't Maula develop a heart of gold when he got into the sixth form?
I think he did, because also, going back to earlier with Chrissy Mannering, Ted, Maula's henchman, was the father, which is a horrible image. Thanks, Grange Hill. Thanks, Phil Redmond. I guess he'll do all this in that film that he's definitely going to make. That's definitely going to happen. I mean, where do you even begin with that? You're going, yeah, we're going to make a film of Grange Hill. And all the kids nowadays are like, what the fuck's Grange Hill? We're just going to make a film about a school. Because you're not going to be able to get anybody. They're not going to go, ooh, who's going to play Ziggy? It's not going to be like the Dad's Army film, you know, that they made for the kids and the Happy Meals a few years ago. It's not going to be as exciting as who's going to play Captain Mannering, as who's going to play Freddie Mannering.
Well, I think the biggest problem with doing that would be the whole point of Grange Hill was that these kids progressed up school. Yeah. And exactly like you say, you followed them. You followed your year. Mm. If you've got a film, it just stands alone. What's going to happen, you know, 6 months after it's out? It's going to be like expecting kids now to identify with some film with Jack Wilde from the 70s where he plays a schoolboy.
Yeah, exactly. It's just, I don't understand where you even begin with it. What's the point?
Did you ever play the Grange Hill ZX Spectrum game?
Of course I did.
In which Gonch and Hollow starred.
Yeah, I did, and also killed them numerous times in the game. Because I think, was it, you could jump off a wall and die? Was it?
Or... Could you? I know if you talked to the drug pusher, you lost the game because you immediately became a heroin addict.
Yeah, that maybe it was that. I've got a feeling, someone will correct me, I'm sure, that I'm sure if you jumped off a wall at a particular point, you would die. But yeah, I did play it, and it was basically a game of, there's a series where every episode starts off with Gonch and Hollow, like, picking up stuff for their enterprises, like collecting enough money to buy a toaster and finding stuff on the scrap heap. So it was the game of that, basically, of them wandering around finding stuff.
There was that strange time in the mid-80s when they tried to make Grange Hill a merchandisable property, and it didn't work, because obviously there was just saying, no, there was the album, which is really weird.
If nobody's ever heard it,
keep it that way. Although Aunt Joan singing I Don't Like Mondays is quite entertaining. Oh, wow. Fancy doing the Walk of Life.
Wow.
And there's a heavy metal song called No Supervision on the Playground.
Wow. Did Fresh and Fly get on there?
No, sadly it's just pre-Fresh and Fly. And, you know, we don't even get that elusive rap by Maluki.
Oh.
But as well as that, I mean, there were always Grange Hill novels, which they were quite faithful to the programme, I'd say. But there were the annuals where they have weird sort of out of uniform photo stories in them. The Summer Special, which I've still got somewhere, which is the most bizarre excuse from a magazine ever. And I don't quite understand what they were playing at, because as well as not really reflecting the programme in any way, also it was something that was about school while you were out of school. And that's not top of anyone's list.
Not really. I don't understand why you'd be interested in that if you liked Grange Hill. But I should point out as well, before we move on from Fresh and Fly, that indeed Fresh and Fly were very good at rapping, but it was young Danny Kendall that was doing all the DJing and mixing. He should get some props as well. That episode was the one where Ziggy announced he was leaving, but he didn't leave, because Mauler chases him to the bus, and he gets on the bus and he goes, "Unlucky, Mauler, I'll never be back again, I'm leaving." And Mauler's like, "You can't leave." He goes, "I am, watch me." And everyone was like, "Oh, no." And I was like, "No." But then the next year started and he was back because his dad had got a job or something. His dad was always threatening to get another job somewhere else and they'd have to move. That was always going on.
Because he didn't make it through to the sixth form, did he?
No.
I don't think Gonch did.
And no.
Robbie had to team up with Mike, the champion runner.
Oh, God,
and then Robbie got involved with football hooliganism.
That's right, because Mike's girlfriend was a person of colour, if I remember rightly. And they went to the football and she got racially abused. And then they got into fights, yeah, and Robbie got a bit too into it. It's a bit like Fight Club. But yeah, it was bad because Robbie should have left. I don't know why he stuck about, because Ziggy gone, Gonch gone, what are you doing? And he ended up just sitting around in the sixth form with a pen behind his ear reading the paper.
He wasn't quite A-level material either, was he? That was Robbie's character. I'm not being so demeaning. It was like, he was a bit of the, he had a dash of the underachiever about him.
He did.
But he had a heart of gold.
Heart of gold. Out of all of them, Gonch was the one you'd imagine he would have stayed on. But I'm guessing with his real name being John Holmes, maybe he went off to make some adult films. Because there's one point where Gonch is selling, he's renting films. And I remember he rents them to the decorators. And they're like, "Oh, I like that film you lent me. It was a bit racy." And I'm sitting there going, a little child is giving grown men racy films to watch in exchange for cash. That's a very odd thing. But yeah, I'm guessing Gonch went off to do some private enterprise of some sort. So I think its strength is there was nothing close to it in terms of what it was talking about, what it was dealing with, apart from adult soaps. There was nothing around at that time that was even close to it. I think if there had have been, then perhaps you'd have had a Neighbours, Home and Away, Corrie, EastEnders situation where you'd have drifted to one and come back to the other when that one got weak. But I thought Grange Hill was just pretty strong all the way through. And if you look back at the people involved in it, wasn't it like Anthony Minghella involved at one point?
Yeah, he was.
Yeah, which is fucking mad when you think about it now. But he was, ladies and gentlemen, involved with Grange Hill. So I think that's why it was so strong. And also, they got very lucky with... I mean, some of the actors are fucking dreadful because they're children. But some of them, like Gonch, is like from day one, he's bang on it.
Well, if you could have adopted one of Gonch's schemes for yourself, what would you have gone for?
It's got to be the Toast Club, isn't it? Because it's such a great idea. Like, it's completely faultless. You buy a toaster for, it's speculate to accumulate, you buy a toaster for how much that was in 1986. You keep it in a little locker and then bring it out in the mornings and make everybody around a toast. Even if the teachers catch you, you're just like, we got no canteen that I can ever see in Grange Hill, so yeah.
Okay, well, John, I'm plugging the Golden Age Children's TV. Is there anything you want to promote?
Just my podcast, Mersh Pod, please. Oh, and a wheezing groaning sound, the Doctor Who podcast to do as well.
Once upon a time, not so long ago, there was a little girl and her name was Emily. And she had a shop. There it is. It was rather an unusual shop because it didn't sell anything. You see, everything in that shop window was a thing that somebody had once lost, and Emily had found, and brought home to Bagpuss. Emily's cat, Bagpuss. The most important, the most beautiful, the most magical, saggy old cloth cat in the whole wide world. Well now, one day Emily found a thing. And she brought it back to the shop and put it down in front of Bagpuss, who was in the shop window, fast asleep as usual. But then Emily said some magic words. Bagpuss, dear Bagpuss, old fat furry catpuss, wake up and look at this thing that I bring. Wake up, be bright, be golden and light. Bagpuss, oh hear what I sing.
Joining me, as far away from Tavish McTavish's bagpipe playing as possible, is entertainment journalist Steve O'Brien. So, Steve, why is Bagpuss and why do you love it so much?
This was the TV show or the children's show that was voted the best of all time at various points. It's the one that sits the most sort of totemically in my memory. I think because it sort of characterises childhood like no other series. It is about imagination. It is about nostalgia. It is about toys. It is about storytelling. And I think all those things kind of make it the sort of the quintessential children's series. And also because within each episode, there are several different expressions of children's TV shows. You know, you've got the stop motion animation of the main Bagpuss character. And then you've got different forms of, you've got some stories told in cartoon form, some stories told in just static form. In some ways, actually, it's an encapsulation of what children's TV looked like in the 1970s, all in one show.
Yes, and also, that's interesting you mentioned that, because I've always had the sort of idea about the fact, you know, it is set in, basically, I suppose, a junk shop, a second-hand shop, although that's not the shop's actual purpose, but it's this kind of conflation of various modes of storytelling over the years. You know, you've got books on the shelf, you've got the mouse organ, which shows, we can assume, probably like little things like, you know, those things that were always at your grandparents where you couldn't work out where they came from and why. When you looked in them, they had a loop of moving film that went round.
Yeah.
And there are puppets that sing and play instruments, and it is like several sort of instances of what were children's entertainment at that point sort of smashed together at a time when I would say some of them were starting to become on the way out, really.
Yeah, I mean, there's an alternative version of this series that you could do with, you know, if you were making it now, 50 years ago, it would be sort of Action Men and Evel Knievel toys, but they don't have that sort of same sense of magic. But yeah, you're right, that these were the toys that they were the dusty remains of our grandparents' childhood. And those toys just don't exist now. Not in houses. They exist in antique shops and they exist on the Antiques Roadshow. But they're not there to be sort of found by young kids, because the toys that they are finding are the Stretch Armstrongs. You know, they're the one, they're the equivalents of everything that's in Bagpuss.
And yes, interestingly, in terms of its place in time, that was, I mean, suppose later on in the 70s, really, that was the rise of branded toy lines. If we assume that they were real toys, you know, things like, I know Professor Yaffle was a bookend, but for the sake of argument, he was handmade, Madeline the Ragdoll was. They weren't part of a marketing blitz. And that's what toys became in that decade. And it's kind of almost a last gasp of representation of that sort of universe of toys, I suppose.
Yeah, I suppose it is a kind of a reaction against sort of that post-war heavily branded form of toy manufacturing. And yeah, it is. I mean, because I think nostalgia is built into its very DNA. I mean, it says not so long ago, but, you know, in the beginning, but this was 1974 and these are Victorian Edwardian photographs. So, it's, you know, it's at least 70 years old. But, you know, I mean, he could have made those photos. He could have made the sort of framing bit of the story kind of modern day. But I think that would have robbed the series of a lot of its mystique and charm. And I think the Victoriana quality and the fact that there are no modern day references in it, there's no songs with a contemporary sound, there's no toys kind of made after about, I don't know, 1910. It just makes it seem more innocent, you know? Like, you know, I know, you know, I mentioned the songs. Like, if Gabriel had been playing something skiffily or beatily, it would have felt wrong. You know, and all those traditional English folk songs, it just makes it feel as though the series is sort of ancient and steeped in these folklore, you know, that these are stories that go back hundreds of years. Because I think it's nostalgic to us now, partly because it reminds us of an older style of television. But when it was made, it was reminding us of an older form of toy playing and childhood.
It was, and also, I have an obsession with the fact that perhaps when it was made, I mean, I don't think this was necessarily Oliver Postgate and Peter Furman's intention, but it wasn't perhaps as out of step with current experiences we might think, because the Victoriana angle might seem out of place, but if you go back a couple of years, what you got, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, everyone jumped onto that Victoriana bandwagon for a bit, and it's sort of, it's at the tail end of that, but it's in there. But also, Gabriel's sort of folky guitar playing, again, very anachronistic, but it's not a million miles away from Jimmy Page, is it? You know, so that sort of stuff was in the air.
Indeed, and you can play the collected songs of Bagpuss next to the Wicker Man soundtrack. And they, you know, these came out a year, 1973 and 1974. You know, there's not much between them. So yeah, you're right. It was absolutely in the air. And maybe, you know, maybe kind of like the good life and that kind of going back to the soil and survivors is all part of this as well. You know, this kind of reaction against, you know, mass consumerism and going back to sort of basics a little bit.
And that brings me on to another point, which is I was quite astonished to find this when I got older, because I was fine watching Bagpuss. It was one of my absolute favourite shows. I have a very vivid memory of once seeing the end of an episode and finding out my cousin had seen the start of it, and between us, you know, aged about four or whatever, we pieced the whole episode together. But when I found out that a lot of people were frightened of it, going all the way from at the one extreme, there's an excellent article out there by Bob Fisher, who has also been on this show, talk about the Owl Service, which isn't actually that far removed thematically. He talks about, you know, the opening sequence and the fact that there is one photograph that sort of really seared into him, which is before you see Emily, you see, I think, is it four children in the distance?
Yeah.
And they almost look faceless. And there's that.
Yeah, that's quite Sapphire and Steel, actually. Yeah.
It is, actually, yes. But at the other extreme, there are people who are just terrified of Professor Yaffle. There seem to be a lot of them. And I don't quite see it, because I was like Professor Yaffle. I was like this rationality and this refusal to tolerate nonsense from any of the others.
Yeah, I don't get the Professor Yaffle thing. John, I looked, obviously, I knew that it was apparently based on, or his voice or characterization was based on Bertrand Russell. So I kind of checked some Bertrand Russell interviews on YouTube, and I must admit, don't quite get it. I think there's, do you know what? I actually hear there's a sort of fussiness and a pedantry to Professor Yaffle. I hear that more of him in certain Doctor Who fans than I do in, like, one of the great philosophers of the 20th century. The sort of, I think you'll find, quality to him. Is somebody, is, you know, that's a character that I recognise.
Oh, believe me, you do get, I think you'll find it a lot about Bagpuss if you ever write about it.
Oh, I bet.
It is as well, effectively, the last, I'm going to be careful how to say this, but the last great small film production. Because after that, you know, they remake in colour either The Engine, which obviously is great, but they've done that before. They're remaking colour Nog in the Nog, but they've done that before. And there are a couple of shows that don't really work. Or, like, Totty, the Story of a Doll's House, terrify a generation of girls out of their wits.
Yeah.
And although, personally, Clangers is my favourite, it is a great note to sort of bow out on, because what an achievement this is. 13 episodes, that's all there ever were, and they repeated constantly. But when you were young, it didn't feel like there were 30 being shown again and again. You thought there were hundreds of these things.
Yeah, it's kind of like the Fawlty Towers of children's TV shows. Have you managed to get to the bottom of why they never made any more? I mean, was it ever officially cancelled? And certainly, you know, this was a big, big show. Like, did the BBC ever ask for more?
I don't really know. It's one of those things that's very difficult to get to the bottom of. I do know, this is a slight exclusive thing here, there was, in 1974, a Bagpuss album planned on BBC Records and Tapes, which I assume would have been, you know, 4 episodes in sound only, but it didn't happen. And that can only be some kind of contractual issue of some kind.
Yeah.
Because I can't see any other reason why that wouldn't happen. So I don't know. Maybe it was 50-50. Maybe there was a little bit. Because don't forget as well, they had external contributors in it. They had John Faulkner and Sandra Kerr, who played Gabriel and Madeline. So there was more to it than just that. And they might have just wanted to move on, really.
Yeah, I think with children's shows, certainly of that era, it seems to be very difficult to gauge their popularity. There's not really sort of ratings out there. And whether something gets recommissioned or cancelled seems to be more at the whim of a controller or head of children's programming than, hey, this isn't hit the marks, or, you know, like ratings wise. I mean, you know, so I have no idea actually when it was originally broadcast, how big it was, or whether it was just, I have a feeling that this was more, it was repeated and repeated and then just gathered, you know, steam throughout the 70s.
Well, most Watch With Mother shows, to be honest, there were usually only 13 episodes of most of them.
Yeah.
And they were, as far as I can tell, locked into a 10-year contract of repeats, because that's why, although Trumpton and Campbell-Witt Green carried on, Chigley disappeared for a couple of years in the late 70s, and that was because the 10 years was up and Gordon Murray wanted, I think the contract for that wasn't as good as it had been for the other two, and given it was being shown just as much, you know, we wanted some kind of parity there. So obviously Bagpuss went on slightly longer than 10 years though. I think it was last shown in 1986 in that regular slot.
Yeah, I have a sort of memory of it still being shown then. I think actually part of the reason why there were only ever usually 13 episodes made is, you know, for commissioners, children's shows are in a way relatively cheap, but they have a long life. You know, you can't endlessly repeat them because there'll be new children to discover them, but also because children don't mind rewatching the same thing about 30 times. You know, you can't re-show Softly Softly, you know, in the same way.
Especially because... not in the lunchtime children's slot. <Yeah. laughs> You know, but there aren't, especially not the spin-off where they hunted Jack the Ripper.
But there aren't, you know, there aren't adult viewers going, oh yeah, I don't mind watching this Softly Softly episode for the 40th time, in a way that kind of like a six-year-old will watch an episode of King Rollo, you know, for the 60th time.
I will say as well that this is so widely disputed, but I am, as far as I'm concerned, you know, it was, I think it was 1986, it was last shown, and then there's this huge gap where I think it turned up on the Children's Channel in the early 90s, because I remember getting some to tape them for me who had cable. But Bagpuss sort of disappeared until about 1999. It suddenly became, you know, OMG, remember Bagpuss, best children's programme ever. And then, you know, you got Singing Mice for sale in W.H. Smith and so on. But there was a number of years where it was almost forgotten.
There was a big explosion of nostalgia shows, I remember, at that time, because I was working on Cult TV magazine about sort of 97, 98, and we got cancelled. And it was, I remember it was just after that, there was this explosion of those 3-hour Channel 4 shows about the best children's shows or the best dramas of all time or whatever. And I remember thinking, God, we just missed that.
Yeah.
So yeah, there was something in the air where people were just wanting to, or maybe it was an end of the millennium thing, but people were just wanting to look back to childhood and were looking back at the 70s and 60s and 70s.
Well, I think also I think it's when you reach a certain age and have a certain level of disposable income, because the example I always point to is when the BBC did a Watch With Mother video in the late 80s and it went absolutely crackers. It outsold Death to the Daleks, which, you know, was the first Doctor Who release at affordable budget price. And Bill and Ben and Andy Pandy outsold it. So then they immediately put out Watch Your Mother the Next Generation, which had Mary Mungo and Midge, The Herbs, Tales from the Riverbank, Pogles Ward and Barnaby. And I remember seeing that advertised in, what, 1987 or something, and thinking, that looks great. I wish I could have that. I don't have any money. And, and I'm a teenager. So I think it takes that little bit of distance distance, but also, crucially, the fact that you can indulge yourself in revisiting things. Yeah. And I think Bagpuss didn't reach that until, you know, people were well into their 20s.
Yeah, and also suddenly those people that have grown up on it, who are about sort of 30 then, and they're beginning to kind of commission programmes and make programmes as well. They're, you know, they're just mining their own, you know, childhoods for this kind of stuff. You know, which is why, obviously, you know, there's always an explosion in Hollywood when they suddenly start remaking series like Beverly Hillbillies in the 90s, and then 10 years after that, it's the A-Team or Starsky and Hutch. And so, yeah, it's just whenever, you know, the powerful people reach a certain age, they look back at the IPs of their youths.
And I will admit, it did become a bit Remember Bagpuss for a bit. It didn't get as bad as Rainbow did, which, to be honest with you, I think that started earlier and it was more offensive because all people did was make drug and sex jokes about Zippy, which, you know, the worst anyone ever said about Bagpuss was, OMG, they must all be on drugs, and, you know, they clearly weren't.
No. I mean, yeah, it never got that.
So who was your favourite character, though?
Do you know what? Having rewatched it again, Yaffle I always thought was the most fun character. Visually, I love Gabriel, but I just don't think the voice is right. And it really takes it. I mean, I don't think I really noticed that as a kid, but I really notice that now. He does the croak, but then when he talks, he's got this really kind of quite lovely, smooth kind of voice. And it's absolutely just wrong for him. So that sort of slightly takes me out of it. Yeah, I'd probably say Professor Yaffle. I think that's the fullest character there. I think he's just, you know, bursting with personality. What about you?
It's Professor Yaffle for me all the way. Even, you know, as a very young child, I just loved the way he jumped down off a procession of piles of books.
Yeah, yeah.
Which, you know, fascinated me because I much later, went on a quest to try and find out what some of those books were. And there are photos out there where you can see the titles of them. And I didn't get very far, but...
Please say it wasn't The Joy of Sex.
It wasn't Skinhead by Richard Allen. No, they were called things like Where to Look for Wild Flowers and Arctic Adventure. And there are dozens of books with those names from earlier in the 20th century. But it just seemed like another time and another place, but also like every charity shop or secondhand bookshop that you, while your parents perused them, you were left looking at something you didn't quite understand.
Yeah.
What is this fluke thing?
Yeah. And it was always books like that. If you kind of like find yourself in the school library in a section that you don't normally go to, and it would just be what appeared to be the most boring books and the most niche boring books in the world.
And also things that were just very slightly out of date, which I think is a phenomenon you don't really get now.
No.
We have a sort of, culturally, you have a sort of perpetual present where everything is in the mix and things from centuries ago get rediscovered. Only the other day, I was astonished to hear somebody singing Lightning Strikes in the style of Klaus Nomi, like a student. And then I found out, apparently, a TikTok clip of Klaus Nomi went viral. So yeah, everything is swirling around now, whereas back then, an annual for a show you didn't remember from 1968 or something could seem like an ancient relic.
I think it's like that with music, you know, because I think that songs exist on playlists, so you can have a Fleetwood Mac song next to a Grimes song or whatever, and it's all just kind of one thing to a lot of kind of Gen Z. I think TV is slightly different because I think that suddenly, as soon as you go from 4K to VT or 4x3 to widescreen, I think suddenly that kind of, I've seen Gen Z talk about TV like that. It feels as though it cuts them off. Whereas I think we always were quite, you know, found an allure in stuff that looked different and had a kind of a misty quality about it, you know, whether if we were watching an old Harold Lloyd or an old Doctor Who, you know, on 45 line, you know, there was a kind of a mystique about it. And that's what I get from watching Bagpuss now. I love that sort of, I love the sepia of the beginning. I love the fact that it's made on, you know, beautiful sort of 16mm film. Even if it had been made on 35mm film, it wouldn't have the same kind of slightly far away quality. You know, it's like when you watch the new Clangers that Daniel Postgate made, and then, you know, it's all 4K and high def, and, well, not 4K, it's high def. And thus, to me anyway, it doesn't have the allure of the original show, but I feel as though the original show would just look too visually unappealing, I think, to a modern Gen Zer. I could be, I've got a 21-year-old daughter, so I've been aware of what stuff she was put off by if I tried to sort of put something in front of her eyes, you know, when she was a teenager. And there were some films that, due to the pace or the look, you know, there's an awful lot of films from that period that haven't been kind of digitally spruced up and just have quite a sort of faded kind of quality. And I suppose it doesn't have that kind of sugar rush visuals that, you know, that they have nowadays. I just fear that a lot of this stuff is going to just get lost because it's not being rediscovered by the new generations.
Well, if it does, you never know. A girl in Victorian clothing might find it and pick it up in a basket and put it in the window of a shop waiting to see somebody collect it.
Exactly, yeah.
Okay, so Steve, I'm plugging the Golden Age of Children's TV. Is there anything you want to promote?
Well, I'm doing a Last of Us bookazine at the moment based on the game and the TV show, a bit more accented towards the TV show. That'll be available, I think, from March. So if you like The Last of Us, I think it's really, really strong bookazine, episode guides, A to Z, etc., etc. There's a very good Vintage Rock Presents Elvis album guide out there, edited by me. That's still in WH Smith. So yeah, that's all I can think of.
To see Lee Ross and the Gift is writer Stephen O'Brien. So Stephen, what is Press Gang and why do you love it so much?
Blimey, what is Press Gang? So Press Gang was a children's TV drama series produced by Richmond Films and Television for Central Television, broadcast on ITV between 1989 and 1993, and it ran for 5 seasons, and it focused on a children's newspaper, the Junior Gazette, which was kind of kick-started by a former Fleet Street newspaper editor called Matt Kerr, and was somehow linked to a local school, Norbridge High. So it was all very parochial. It's a big deal for a local area. And this newspaper was headed up by strong-minded Linda Day, suitably assisted by placid Kenny Phillips, another cast of many talented people in the newsroom, most notably brash American Spike Thompson. For those people listening, it was a real mix between comedy and drama. Probably the perfect mix in many ways, in the sense that the comedy didn't outweigh the drama, and probably vice versa. It did cover a lot of sort of issue-based things like drug abuse, child abuse, etc. But it also dealt with the minutiae of being a young person growing up and the trials and tribulations of teenagehood as well. And I think it's fair to say, for reasons that will become obvious, I really loved it. It still remains my favourite TV series ever. And I don't think anything will come along to change that.
Well, I've got to say, you've got a rare honour here, which you probably don't even realise are going to bestow on you, which is that Press Gang are very revered. We do have a situation where there are a lot of people who want themselves to be seen as, you know, the biggest Press Gang fan, the OG Press Gang fan. You were the first person I ever heard mention Press Gang, because we used to watch every children's ITV drama and children's BBC that was on, you know, mainly looking for ideas as much as enjoying the shows in themselves. But for some reason, I wasn't in on the day the very first Press Gang went out. I can't remember what I was doing, but I remember you saying to me a couple of days later, in fact, maybe even the next day, oh, it was really, really good. You were the first person I ever heard mention Press Gang, so you walk away with that title as far as I'm concerned. Well, you probably mentioned it even before Stephen Moffat did.
Well, it was interesting because, like you say, you and I, you know, would watch a lot of the children's shows. Right? Well, obviously, we were teenagers at the time, weren't we? And I think the whole thing about us at the time being interested in sci-fi and fantasy shows, and typically at that time in the UK, you'd only really get those in the children's slots. You know, so we would watch those things, and I would often rather speculatively record these series, at least the first episode, you know, just to see how it played out. But the interesting thing about Press Gang is, I only became aware of it, I think, a week before. There was nothing, I don't remember anything looking or the press. I just happened to see the trailer for Press Gang. You know, it was all shot on film, it was fast paced. I recognised a few faces in the cast, and I just thought, wow, that looks really interesting. So I dutifully pressed record and play, I think 4:45 on that particular day, and I just loved it. You know, and I think looking back now, like most shows, whilst it was a really good opening episode, it wasn't a kind of a patch on what followed or what followed quickly. But, you know, it just sold me straight away. The way it was shot, the way it was performed, the way it was written, just stylistically, it just seemed to set itself head and shoulders apart from anything else on TV, not just actually in the children's slot, but also probably the adult slot as well.
Yes, definitely. I mean, I do, in the Golden Age of Children's TV, I do make the point that while I am not usually on board with overhyping things, as you are all too aware, we won't be mentioning Moondial at any point in the near future, but I do say that at that point, Press Gang on children's television was better than anything the viewing audience's parents were watching. I do stand by that. I have carefully gone and looked at what else was on around the same time as that first series, just in case I was missing, you know, the Monocle Mutineer or something from my analysis. But yeah, I think during that stretch, absolutely far and away the most sophisticated programme on television.
Yeah, I mean, the only other candidates I can think of is Billy's Christmas Angels the year before. No, but seriously, I think...
You might have to explain that later.
No, I think you're right. And I think, you know, I think anybody who's looked into Press Gang at all will probably be aware that Stephen Moffat was a school teacher when he started writing Press Gang. And actually, he was a school teacher for, I think, the first two seasons of Press Gang. He kind of did both, you know, alongside each other, which must have been a real undertaking. But when he first got the commission, he did speak to his pupils and say, you know, what shows do you like? And the kind of things, the main one that came out really was Moonlighting. You know, and obviously anybody who's watched even 5 minutes of Press Gang will see that the influence of Moonlighting is in there. But in fairness to Stephen Moffat, you know, it's not just purely a carbon copy. He takes that as a starting point and makes it his own.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, Moonlighting's the obvious reference point. I think there was a lot more in there that doesn't get acknowledged. I mean, when I was watching that first series at the time, what it really reminded me of, although it didn't, I say it didn't quite have the same level of absurdity, but sometimes it did actually, but it was Hot Metal, the ITV late Sunday night satire show based on, well, a tabloid newspaper. And I felt there was, I mean, Stephen might say, no, that wasn't the case, but I always felt there was a lot of that in there. You know, that again was quite a sophisticated influence to have. And it was taking something that you might have seen. If you were lucky, you were allowed to stay up on a Sunday night to watch those ITV shows. But it was giving it to you in a time slot where you were allowed to watch it. And, like, at first, nobody even noticed it.
And I think there was that thing, and some people might be aware that I went on to do a fanzine for Press Gang and did some conventions.
You've got to tell the whole story.
Yeah, and we'll come into that. But I think part of the reason why I did that was because I felt Press Gang wasn't getting the coverage it deserved. Even the things they're looking would only cover it occasionally. There's a few things in the press, but compared to other shows, like particularly Grange Hill, there was not much to read on it. You know, if you really like something the way I really like Press Gang, you wanted to understand a bit more about it. So that's why I did that. But clearly, that's suggestive of the point you make, is that for quite a while it did go under the radar, even though it was pretty popular with the target audience. Most people I knew, maybe not from day one like me, but certainly quite quickly or midway through that first season, a lot of people in my school were talking about Press Gang, really enthusing about it, in the way nobody really enthused about Grange Hill. We all watched Grange Hill and enjoyed it to a point, but this was something different. And I think even now, when I think about people's reactions to Press Gang, the two extremes are there's people who've never seen it or are possibly indifferent to it, or people absolutely love it. I haven't really met many people. I know there will be people listening to this who will occupy that middle space. But for me, I've never really met people who said, yeah, it was all right. Either people really get it, or they don't, or they've never heard of it.
Yes, and it's interesting as well that there seems to be a consensus that it was great right the way through, which, again, is going to tie in with your story when you come to it, was I mean, you have put up with this longer than anyone else possibly, but I have a tendency to like things more when they first start out, when people haven't quite figured out what they're doing yet before they lock into a groove. Like, famously, I'm the only person in the world who prefers David Bowie's 1967 albums or anything that came later, or, you know, the first series, The Goodies, where it's more like a prog rock satire, really. And with Press Gang, with those, the first two series in particular, God, sound like my opinions on Red Dwarf here, but the third as well to an extent, but, you know, you've got that huge ensemble cast and it, some stories each week, a bit like The Simpsons actually, don't involve the whole cast, they involve some of them, and, you know, you get that interesting mix-up, and later it becomes more focused on a certain subsector of the staff of the Union Gazette, and then they leave school and it, you know, becomes about them. I found it less interesting then, and I kind of tailed away from it. It's interesting to see that
it has sort of evened out in public opinion. And I did rewatch it recently, and I didn't feel that tail off as sharply as I did at the time. I mean, it was still there for me, but it's interesting that you never, in a vertical, was lost faith in it at all.
No, and I think I'm with you. Obviously, I just made a comment earlier about the first episode, you know, looking back at it now and comparing it, probably unfairly, with what follows. It's probably not as polished as what came on, even quite quickly in that first season, but it's still a solid first episode. And I think there's a certain sort of almost a punkish attitude to the first half of that first season, where they are finding the feet, but they find it pretty quickly. And I think that's reflected in what the team are doing in terms of, you know, dealing with the newspaper, preserving it and whatever. I think by episode 4 or 5 of that first season, they find the feet and then they're off. Season 2 for me still remains my favourite run of Press Gang. There's just a feel to it, there's a cohesiveness to it, and that sort of sense that they're building towards this finale of leaving the school. And I think the other thing that worked for me is in terms of me being in my school year, I was sort of in line with the Junior Gazette staff as well, going through school and then leaving or going to sixth form. Your comments are really interesting, Tim, about, I'm going to use the word tail off. I don't think, maybe you don't mean it that way, but there is a clear shift change. And it's really interesting because obviously they do leave school and they make the Junior Gazette a going concern. And I think from seasons 3 and 4, which were filmed back to back, and then there was a gap and then they filmed season 5, it does become a lot more adult quite quickly. So that whole thing about the teenage problems and that sort of levity that you, the highs and lows you have as a teenager, that are reflected in season 1 and 2, probably flip in seasons 3, 4 and 5 to almost like a kind of an adult wariness about it. There's also seems to be less people around, so it seems like a bit of a slightly reduced proposition.
Yes,
scale.
I noticed that, yeah.
But I think the one comment I did want to make, and this might make me quite unpopular, is that when Press Gang was cancelled, it was cancelled by the new head of children's programming for ITV, Dawn Airey, and the reason she gave, and it might not be the sole reason or the main reason for the cancellation, she said something to the effect of, Press Gang has outgrown its slot. Now, there might be other reasons why she cancelled it. Most people come in and want to make their own stamp on their programming slot, you know, if they're a controller, or a channel or a department. So it's likely she came in and sort of said, well, actually, I want to put my stamp on children's. I want to do this. That's probably the more pragmatic reason why it ended. But I do have some, as I look back now, and I was devastated when it did end, but looking back on it now, she does have a point. I do think it did outgrow its slot. You know, it was still very popular. It was still fantastically made, written, produced, acted. But there was that sense, particularly with the final season, it wasn't really a children's show anymore. I mean, there's an argument to say, was it ever really a children's show? But at least in seasons 1 and 2, it was probably an adult show dressed up as a children's show. But I think seasons 3 onwards moved away from that and it did become more adult. You know, there was one point where Lewis Rudd of Central Television was lobbying Central or ITV to show the episode where Spike and Linda got together at Last the Dragon. He was lobbying to get that show on ITV at like 6:30 so people could see, you know, what Press Gang was, and he felt to deserve that slot. Now, that didn't come off. But even just some of those things, they're thinking, probably it transcended children's. Maybe it wasn't quite adult enough to be on in the evening, but until Channel 4 came along, actually, ironically, repeated Press Gang later on, there seemed to be a gap between children's and adult television where the teen audience or the young adult audience weren't really catered for properly, I think. So it's interesting what you say, because whilst I would have loved it to carry on, I do have some agreement with it that it probably did outgrow the slot.
So go on, we might as well go on to this. How did you personally get involved with Press Gang?
It was interesting because I, thinking for a year or two, I'd love to do a fanzine on Press Gang. For the reasons I said before, there was not much to read on it. But by the time I sort of got my act together and sort of had the courage to say, right, I'm going to write to Richmond Films, I'm going to write to Sandra Hastie and ask you if I can do this, whether it's in an official capacity.
I remember you telling me you were going to do it.
Or in an official capacity. So I wrote a 2 or 3 page letter and sort of outlined what I'd like to do and how I'd like to do it. And then a week or two later, the phone rang, you know, at home. I just picked it up and the voice said, hi, is that Stephen? It's Sandra Hastie here. And I could not believe it. I wasn't expecting a response, to be honest with you, Tim. You know, even though I'd being very polite in my letter, very hopefully articulate. But I wasn't expecting the call. You know, I had a great interest in TV, and the producer of my favourite show had phoned me, and we had a great chat, and she said, yeah, love you to do it. Why don't you come down and we'll have a bit more of a chat about it? So a few weeks later, and I have relatives in London, which is incredibly helpful. So I went down to London, went to the Richmond Films office in Soho, met Sandra, who was absolutely lovely, full of life, full of ideas, just totally won me over. And then she said, oh, by the way, Stephen's going to come over. And then Stephen Moffat, he goes, yeah, he's down because they're recording Joking Apart. So he's going to come over to meet you as well. And so Stephen came over, which was amazing. So the two of them there. And then Lewis Rudd, you know, he came over as well. And Tim, you and I, even at that stage, we knew who Lewis Rudd was through the shows he'd been involved in that in many cases we had never seen.
Yes.
we'd read so much about. So, you know, these three people there and me, there in the afternoon, just having a really chat about not just press gang, but everything. And they showed an interest in me, which was really interesting. Not in an interview way, just like a genuine chat. And I really felt welcomed and, you know, listened to and sort of, and understood as well. And, you know, on the back of that, you know, I did the fanzine and I did four issues over a couple of years. There was a fifth issue that was completed but never came out because at that point I was scanning photographs and the files were too big for my printer to handle. So I have got the files somewhere. So if I dig them out and I can convert them, I might get issue 5 out only like 30 years later. So I did the fanzine had a really good response all over the world, actually. You know, that led to a lot of people writing to me. One person then actually sent me some information she'd been sent by another person who worked for Future Publishing, who was at the same time as me, pitched a press gang fanzine to Sandra Hasty and was turned down. And I couldn't believe it, because not only was this person a magazine professional, his proposal of what he was going to do with it just blew mine away.
We should just clarify, it wasn't your magazine namesake, Steve O'Brien, who gets mistaken for you all the time. That's about press gang everywhere he goes.
This is really embarrassing, because Steve, what a fantastic guy. Such a talented writer and journalist. Unbelievable, the success he's had in that field. So I have to say, I'm really embarrassed the fact that he gets asked if he did the press gang stuff. And nobody's ever asked me, did you write for Total Film or SFX? But, you know, credit where credit's due. What an absolute talent Steve is. And if he's listening, I apologise, Steve, for the inane questions you might get about press gang.
And we should just say at this juncture, you know, you had this incredibly successful fanzine breakfast at Czar's with loads of people writing for it. I didn't actually contribute that much. I'd kind of lost interest in press gang a bit. There was dimming other stuff at the time. Ironically, one of which was writing to, because I used to write to a lot of people who, you know, did stuff I found quite interesting in sort of the NME or whatever, or on Radio 4. That's how I initially got writing to Stuart Lee and Richard Herring, who, of course, regularly mentioned Press Gang and Julia Sawalla in their early shows. So it was a weird... You just couldn't escape Press Gang. But I did actually write a short story, which Stephen Moffat told me was his favourite in that short story issue, and still quite proud of that. The other thing is I've got a very fond memory of at a mutual friend's birthday party explaining who Blur were to Stephen when it was just before they got big. He's not a complete cultural ignoramus.
One of the real benefits of doing the fanzine is obviously I had a really good relationship with Sandra Hasty, but a really good relationship with Stephen Moffat at the time. And aside from the fanzine business, Stephen would often phone me and we'd have a good chat and stuff. And on the back of that and the fanzines, you know, he would come up and to certain events we'd have, or some of us would have parties. And Stephen really became a part of that group for a while. And whilst it's been quite some years since I've been in touch with Stephen, you know, I remain very fond of Stephen. And indeed, Sandra, the way they sort of opened up to me, you know, extended the hand of friendship, the welcome they gave me, the support they gave me, the friendship they gave me, I can't thank them enough, honestly. And even the people I met around them, some of the cast members, some of the production team, everybody happily gave the time to me, spoke to me. So to all those people, a big thank you. It was a really interesting time of my life. And I think the main reason the fanzine kind of came to a natural end, apart from the print problems I mentioned before. And we did that for a couple of years, and we did the conventions on the back of it. And obviously other aspects of life kind of kick in, you know, and other things sort of vie for the attention. So it wasn't necessarily a thing to sort of say, I'm stopping it. I'd just like to say the gaps between issues got longer. And this is the longest one yet, probably.
But there were those two events, both sides of the paper. I never liked the word conventions, but I suppose that's what most people would call them. But people came from the other side of the world. For them, it was quite astonishing. My one
bugbear that still remains about that was, do you remember who the guest who pulled out was, who I was going to meet at Lime Street Station?
Was that Lucy Benjamin?
It was Lucy Benjamin, yes. Yeah. I think probably for her sake, it's probably better I didn't meet her at Lime Street Station. But
yeah, she phoned on the day. I called to the reception of the hotel and she phoned up and she'd had car issues and was very apologetic. Again, I met Lucy a couple of times. Such a lovely person. Absolutely lovely person. Paul Reynolds, fantastic guy. Kelder, Dexter, you know, Nick Stringer, all lovely people. What I can say is when we had that first convention, we did two, both of them in Liverpool. I think there was a year apart between them. But certainly that first one, I remember Sandra Hastings in particular was absolutely bowled over because she'd never been to a convention before. I mean, we've said this before, Tim, haven't we? You know, what I kind of tried to do with Press Gang was kind of create a fandom for a non-sci-fi and fantasy show because obviously there were always fanzines and conventions about Blake 7, Doctor Who, Star Trek, but more conventional shows. And perhaps actually Press Gang is not that conventional given where it was and the talent involved. But it wasn't strictly science fiction or fantasy. So I like to think it was trying to break new ground in some ways of trying to start a fandom up around something that wasn't sci-fi and fantasy. So clearly, Sandra or any of the others had ever been to a convention, let alone a convention for a show they were involved in or created. Sandra Hastings was just blown away. She couldn't believe how many people turned up. She couldn't believe the dedication these people had, the questions they're asking, the love they had of the show that she'd overseen. And clearly Stephen and the cast really appreciated that as well. But for Sandra, it was just eye-opening. I don't think she expected it. It just blew away. You know, and things like that, aside from other fans being able to meet Sandra and Stephen and the cast who turned up and obviously bid in our charity auctions, the fans had a great time and it was for other fans we did it. But I like to think that particularly Sandra saw firsthand the impact the show had had, her work had had on people. Because I know she knew about people saying how great it was, but to see it unfold on that day the way it did, it just knocked up a six.
How do you feel now about... I still think Press Gang had a sort of wilderness years, because even those two like events took place after it had been cancelled.
They did.
And there was a long time where I don't think it's quite like, I will argue the case that certain other programmes have been completely forgotten until people rediscovered them. You know, they've been and gone. Press Gang didn't quite go away because it was always sort of mentioned in, you know, articles in The Guardian and so on. And there were the Channel 4 repeats. But I think it's only a bit later when the DVDs come out that it starts to get attention again. And then obviously when Stephen got involved with the rebooted Doctor Who, I think suddenly it leapt up in terms of profile. So how do you feel about that gap now where it was sort of ironically yesterday's news for a bit?
It's interesting because, and we've talked about this, about all these shows, haven't we, about legacies they have and all these shows like Doctor Who where, you know, generally did have wilderness years. And I think for Press Gang is, I think in many ways, I wouldn't call them wilderness years because I didn't really expect it to have an ongoing life, so to speak. You know, I loved it. Lots of people loved it. But I think there was that kind of thing. It's because it, despite being successful and popular, it still kind of bubbled under the radar to some extent. So when you're kind of used to a programme like that happening, you don't sort of expect anything to come back up. And I think you're absolutely right. I think when Stephen Moffat became involved in Doctor Who, the fans then say, what else has he done? And clearly people read Press Gang, and it did kind of explode again. I mean,
nobody clamoured for exam conditions, though, did they? Which is what I really felt deserved.
Or The Office.
Yes, the original The Office with Stephen Dennis.
That you and I have talked about before, haven't we? I think it's interesting because there's often this thing in fandom or where people like things whereby you have the early adopters and then you have the... what you might want to call the stragglers. In terms of, I'm using technical terms there, it's sort of in IT or technology, the terms are, you know, early adopters and then the stragglers. And I think there's some people, and you and I have seen this, Tim, where a show will come out or a band will come out and they're under the radar and then you've got the early adopters who were there from day one. And then when it becomes bigger and becomes public property, the early adopters kind of resent the stragglers. Yeah. Hang on, I was here first. I was there on the ground floor, to paraphrase Colin Matthews. And, you know, and I think, I mean, I remember this with many things, but for me, as an early adopter, as you said before, and as you were too, I was absolutely delighted that everybody leapt on Press Gang because it was long overdue. And the more people who get to see it and evangelise for it, is great for me. You know, I'm great for the show. It deserves wider exposure, even beyond what it's got now. I would still recommend anybody to watch Press Gang because it's so rich, there's so much to it. And it's great because, I mean, and more recently, there's two brilliant guys from America who are Doctor Who fans and kind of came to Press Gang partly through the Stephen Moffat association with Doctor Who. And they've watched it in recent years and they've absolutely fallen for a hook, line and sinker. And I've had many chats with them. They've kind of interviewed me, but we've become friends. And my other friend, Carrie, who you mentioned before, who went to the conventions from Australia, she kind of put me in touch with Nick and John. So their latter day, they didn't watch it as teenagers. They've come to it later in life and have absolutely loved it. I think what the show does even now, it taps into that perennial thing about us all being, we were all young once, we were all teenagers once. And either you can watch it now, whether you watch it as a repeat or you come to it fresh, the stories, the characters resonate with you because it kind of takes you back. So it still has that power, even though it's 30 odd years old now. I still think it has that power. And, you know, it's great. I mean, it's great. In many ways, Nick and John do a lot of research into the show, some phenomenal research. They want to do a book, which will be fantastic. They've set up the Press Gang Fan Club of America, which is fantastic. I love all this. I wish them well. I'll support them as much as I can because they're kind of taking the baton on from what I started and what others have done in the meantime. Let's not forget, when I, around the same time I did Breakfast of Czars, there was an Australian fanzine called Gangway because it was really popular there. Mark and Nick, who helped me on Breakfast of Czars, went on to do the Julia Gazette. So other things sort of spun out of this as well, and other people have done lots of things about it. Sue Cowley's done a great Press Gang website as well. Others have done stuff. So it's great to see that people are still out there doing this stuff and taking it forward. I just think it's fantastic because any exposure this fantastic show gets is great in my book.
And we should just say, if anyone is interested in Breakfast at Czars, and in particular in my short story, which, do you know what? I read it again recently. I thought I'd be embarrassed by it. I wasn't. But you can find scans of the issues if you can get hold of the Press Gang DVDs. But also, we should just mention, I'll be honest, I completely slipped my mind till now, you also co-wrote the Press Gang Programme Guide, which I understand is still available from Leo Mack Publishing.
Yes.
Apparently, the publisher of that, I don't know if he knew this, he was championing diversity decades before it became fashionable. He never tells anyone that.
I don't think he's mentioned that to me. Yes, so our friend David Waddell did fund the publishing of the Press Gang Programme Guide. And I think Dave does still have some copies if anybody's interested. I am surprised, you know, maybe something I need to have a word with Dave about, and Jim, of course, was the main author and the editor of the book, whether it's time to see if we can get it out on Kindle or something, because I think my contributions were relatively small to that book, but Jim and Steve Lyons contributed to it as well, and we had a foreword from Sandra Hastie, an endnote from Stephen Moffat, but Jim did a fantastic piece of work in that book, and, you know, and all credit to David for agreeing to fund and publish it. But yeah, maybe that's something I need to speak to Jim and David about, and whether we can do something with that. But yeah, great piece of work. It's great to be involved in that too.
Well, one thing he won't be writing a book about, I did tell you and make you explain this, is Billy's Christmas Angels. So come on,
just before we go on to Billy's Christmas Angels, it might be I'm trying to avoid it. I would just say, obviously, Timmy just mentioned that the PDFs of Breakfast is Ours, it might also be time for me to put those online myself, along with hopefully the long-awaited issue 5. It would be nice to get that out, I think. So what's this space? Billy's Christmas Angels. I genuinely don't know where to start. Billy's Christmas Angels was a BBC one-off drama shown around Christmas time, as the title suggests. I think it was 1988, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Now, I wasn't expecting to ask me about this. It's my own fault for bringing it up. I don't even know how to describe it, Tim, but it was, I remember the Mint Juleps were in it, weren't they? And they were singing, well, they were the Christmas Angels, I guess, weren't they?
Yes, yeah, they sang an a cappella version of Dancing in the Dark.
We had John Shackley from the Tripods. Was he Billy or was he just...
No, Billy was the younger brother, because John Shackley's character... See, I'm struggling to explain this even now. He pawned his guitar to buy their mum a Christmas present, and Billy went to get the guitar back, but for some reason, he got into some kind of gangland trouble on the way involving the Beale Shabam, and the Mint Juleps had to guide him through his quest through via sort of a cappella left-wing socialist soul.
The only disappointing thing for me is, given John Shapley's involvement, that there wasn't a protracted stop at a French vineyard. Again, as I mentioned before, if I saw anything that looked vaguely interesting in the schedules, I would record it. And somewhere on VHS, I do have Billy's Christmas Angels. So
have you still also got Jackson Pace, The Great Years, and Bradley?
I've got all of Jackson Pace. I've got a few episodes of Burt Radley, starring Paul Bradley of EastEnders fame. I've also got How to Be Cool, as you know, which I need to convert from my VHS.
Yes, which is a show we have to be a little careful about these days, yeah, because of one of the cast. But yeah, it was a genuinely, genuinely great... I mean, if we're talking about lost things that would have worked as well for adults as for children, for anyone who doesn't know, adaptation of an early Philip Pullman book on ITV on Saturday afternoons. And basically, they've taken the book and turned it into something somewhere between... Because it's about the government control fashion, basically... And they, kind of a bit topical at the moment in a way, they make enemies of some teenagers who've decided to create their own fashion. But the whole thing is somewhere between A Clockwork Orange and The Prisoner. And I'm not just saying that as hyperbole. There are direct references to both,
absolutely,
in there.
Yeah, so but obviously one of the cast members means it will never get released or shown again, unfortunately. I am probably the only person who recorded it, because I recorded anything that was vaguely interesting.
Including the Snow Spider.
Including the Snow Spider, music, which is on beforehand, yeah, of course. Bobby, can I just talk a little bit about the tripods?
Go on, of course. So, you never need to have permission to talk about the tripods.
I mean, obviously, I know the tripods is mentioned in your book, isn't it? And I think, you know, for anybody who doesn't know, the tripods was a BBC TV series, ran to two seasons, 1984 and 85. It was based on a trilogy by John Christopher. So it was basically about some kind of post-apocalyptic future where human civilization has kind of reverted to, I don't know, sort of like a pre-industrial revolution type thing, the horse and cart, more primitive ways of producing food. But the world is controlled and dominated by alien creatures in machines known as the tripods. And what the three books follow, three teenagers, Will, Henry and Beanpole, as they try to find a way to fight against the tripods. And the books take them through a certain journey to achieve that. So the BBC show should have ran to three seasons, a sore point for Tim and I in many
ways. Very much so.
It was highly ambitious. It was fairly expensive for the time, very forward-thinking in terms of its video effects, doing things that hadn't really been done in video effects before. And it was a really interesting show. And this one, the reason I want to talk about it is that, and we've talked about this many times before, as of many other people, it's a show called The Tripod. And all the pre-publicity had these fantastically designed three-legged alien creatures, alien machines. So if the show's called The Tripods, and you've got these tripods, you sort of expect that the show based around those. Now, apart from episode one, the tripods barely featured, certainly in season one. And instead, you sort of see, you had drawn out episodes of the three teenagers trying to haggle their way onto a boat to go to France, stay in the vineyard, traipsing through a devastated Paris, and some bizarre happenings in a deserted department store.
Don't forget the forest where they meet those people in weird clothes and nothing happens.
The reason I wanted to mention it is I've watched The Tripods recently again. The reason I wanted to mention it, because what we watched it, because at the time, and we talked about this at the time, Tim, although we liked it, we were quite critical about it, because you're sort of thinking, where are the bloody tripods? Where's all the lasers? Where's all? Why are we watching two lads trampling on grapes for 10 minutes of an episode? And, you know, and the second season was a bit better in the sense that, you know, but again, even the first few episodes, two of the characters join some kind of proto-Olympic type event so they can seek themselves into the tripod City of Golden Lead. Once you get into the City of Golden Lead, the five or six episodes in the middle of that second run, it really picks up and you get, right, you're watching a sci-fi show now, but season one wasn't very sci-fi. So the point I'm trying to make is, having watched it 40 years on, I get it now. And I really, you know what, I really enjoyed both seasons. I still think, as we said before, really, they should have done three sets of six, compressed the story and told the whole story. I understand why at the time they sort of expanded the story into 12 or 13 episode seasons. But what I found a bit of a drag watching something and what I felt at the time was a false promise. I get it now. I watch it this time as a kind of rites of passage, a hero's journey thing about these three boys going on this journey to do something where the tripods, at least in season one, are almost incidental. If you watch it in that frame of mind, it works, it's a really good show. But at the time, I understand why people were disappointed, because it was sold as a big sci-fi epic and there wasn't much sci-fi in it at all. But at the same time, I sort of think you couldn't have called it The White Mountains after the name of the first book, because that wouldn't have really enticed people. So of course you've got to call it The Tripods. Of course you've got to sell it on The Tripods. But I understand why people were cheated, because the tripods were barely in it. When they were in it, they made the presence known. The video effects, along with the visual effects, worked incredibly well. And it had a fantastic score from Ken Freeman. The three leads were really engaging as well. Even Kerry Seal, who played Jean-Paul, a.k.a. Beanpole, who at the time I was convinced he was French. But having watched it recently, it's probably the worst French accent ever. And I appreciate what it actually is he looks French rather than sounds French. But again, it doesn't matter, because he's so engaged in the performance, you almost forget about the fact he's not really French at all and he's more Bristolian. But I think I just wanted to mention this because the tripods, even if people are fondness for it, it does get a lot of stick, because purely the basis is it didn't fulfil or didn't deliver what was promised. And I totally get that. But I think I would just like to urge people, if they get the opportunity, to watch it again. But watch it from the point of view is you're watching a rite of passage, hero's journey, adventure serial, rather than a sci-fi serial. And I think if you watch it and go into it with that frame of mind, I think you might quite enjoy it.
Well, you might, but there's no third series.
Yeah, there's no third series, so yeah.
I did once do, as a joke, an artist's impression of what a third series in 1986 might have looked like, and they mocked it up in paint, actually, and had a tripod and Phil Cool and a can of Citrus Spring and Pob and Max Headroom, Alec Christie from the Children of Green, no, put all the 1986 icons in there, and somebody thought it was real. Said, are they actually making it?
There's your first mistake, Tim, because you actually included a tripod in your proposal. Yeah, and I think, you know, just in closing, again, the tripods is a really good example of the BBC saying, we probably haven't got the money and resources to do this, but we're going to do it anyway. And I think for me, I really admire the ambition of the show, particularly, as I mentioned before, with the video effects and the visual effects. Some of them work really well even now, some of them less so. My understanding of what tools were available to the team at the time and what they achieved, I think what they achieved was remarkable.
Okay, so Stephen, I'm plugging the Golden Age Children TV. Is there anything you want to promote?
Not at this point in time, actually. I might be doing some stuff with the two American guys I mentioned before about the Press Gang book. I have a few books in draft that I'm working on, which are taking a lot longer than I anticipated. One of those is about 80s Europop, i.e. a UK view on the music and songs that would find their way over from the continent, and how they sort of, what they said about their countries and how it sort of educated us in the UK around European culture. I'm also working on a book, Brilliantly Ridiculous Moments in Pop Music, odd parts of records or videos that have amused me over the years. So I'm working through the first volume of that as well.
Hello, I'm Paul Abbott, and joining me here in a kind of pastoral white void, if such a thing is possible, is author Tim Worthington. So, Tim, what is The Magic Roundabout, and why do you love it so much?
Well, I do love a good white void, I will say that to begin with, but The Magic Roundabout is, well, technically it's a BBC show, but it's also really, as I'm sure we'll cover, a French show, which sort of outgrew its origins, which for a very long time was in the what used to be the 5-minute slot before the news, the early evening news bulletin, on or late afternoon rather, depends how you define it, on BBC One. Why do I love it so much? Well, I think that can be best illustrated by, reputedly as a very young child, I heard the music of the Magic Roundabout issuing from another room and apparently tried to walk straight through a closed door in my haste to see it.
Well, that is, you know, these things do inspire affection. I remember it from being a kid, because I think it was repeated. As, I mean, we'll do the dates in a bit, but we're talking about a 1960s, early 70s show, essentially. But it was repeated right up into the mid-80s, relentlessly. So I remember it as being a thing that I used to watch as a kid. Although I have this memory of really liking episodes where the character Paul appeared. And one of the boys in it is called Paul, but apparently doesn't appear in it at all, really. So I don't know where I got that memory from. I must have just seen one where he was named and just been like, well, I'm going to watch it again just in case Paul turns up.
Well, that's an interesting angle, is that obviously the main child character people remember from it, because we should just say it's set in a sort of indefinable magic garden where there are some children, some very odd characters who will come back to sort of anthropomorphic Lord knows what they are in some cases, but Florence is the main one. But she had three friends, Paul, Basil and Rosalie, who apparently were more frequently seen in the black and white ones in the 60s. They appeared less later on, but they were always in all of the tie-in merchandise. So if you ever had anything like a magic roundabout lampshade, there is a chance that Paul was on that.
Oh, yes. I may have seen him in other areas anyway. Yeah, that's just a strange thing that I always think about when I think back to the magic roundabout. But yes, I remember it being on. It was on a lot. So let's go back. The first question is one word, origin.
Well, that's France in 1963. And it was an animated series created by an advertising executive called Serge Dano, who just had the idea for this series and made it in a basically a converted mansion where they kept blowing the lights because, you know, they ran it off the mains while they were making the, I don't know if it was the initial batch of episodes or just, you know, the tryout, the what we call a pilot now. But it took off in France in the sense that it was a big, you know, I think it's just like another children's show that people remember in France. But what happened was the BBC in the early to mid 60s in particular were really keen on buying in programmes from Europe, not just, you know, as a cheap way, although it was a relatively cheap way of filling the schedules, but because it was seen as having value to expose children to other cultures and other traditions of storytelling. There was actually a famous strand called Tales from Europe where they bought in serials from quite often from behind the Iron Curtain, things like The Boy and the Pelican and so on. People may remember some of the big serials they bought in, like The Singing Ringing Tree, which has a lot in common visually with the Magic Roundabout, The White Horses, The Flashing Blade, Adventures of Robinson Crusoe, Belle and Sebastian, who obviously, if you're thinking that's the name of a band, yes, it is the name of a band, but they share a lot in common with that black and white serial, more than the French-Japanese animated version from the late 80s that people would probably think of first. But there was this willingness to expose children to what were then cultures that you just wouldn't come across anything from in your everyday life. You know, there wasn't the mass communication we have now. And I can't remember who it was. It may have been Joy Whitby, but it's one of the, because that's something really worth addressing. Most of the executives in the children's department were female at that point, you know, which is a very much ahead of its time, even at the BBC. I think it may have been Joy Whitby saw it for sale at kind of a, you know, a European. They used to have television trade fairs where there'd be stands advertising programmes. Yeah. Get your Singing Ringing Tree here. But she thought, I like the look of that, and inquired about buying it. And when they received it, there were two problems that they didn't like the original soundtracks and the original characters. I mean, if you've ever seen any of the French episodes, they're very noisy and very fast, and there's a lot of jabbering from the various characters.
Multiple voices rather than one narrator. Yeah.
And as they quite often did with shows like this, like, for example, The Singing Ringing Tree was more or less a direct translation, but it was Tony Bilbo who presented Late Night Lineup who was brought in to do that. So for the Magic Roundabout, they got Eric Thompson, who, amongst many other things, was a play school presenter, alongside his wife, Phyllida Law. And actually, he's the father of Emma and Sophie Thompson as well. So it's, you know, a huge acting dynasty. Basically, they just said to him, have a look at these, see what you think, what comes into your head, write it down, record a couple of examples, we'll see how it goes. And he just almost from nowhere, because he was part of the, you know, he's a little bit older, but he was part of the same fringe theatre scene that roughly a contemporary, they'd be on the fringe lot. And, you know, the same sort of thing that Python came out of. There was that droll humour was in there from the start. The kind of contempt for the establishment and for, you know, the significance of the news and men in bowler hats and so on really found its way into it. And he gave these sort of gaudy, brightly coloured characters actual powerfully offbeat characters. I mean, people obviously mostly remember Dougal the dog and Zebedee, who is ostensibly a jack-in-the-box with a huge moustache. But when you think about Ermintrude the cow, who's this, allegedly he based it on Phyllida Law, but, you know, this incredibly flamboyant theatrical type. It's a pink animated cow, and also there's a very indolent rabbit who I think was called Flappy in France, who became Dylan. And, you know, Bob Dylan was, I mean, as you will well know, because on your podcast, The Big Beatles Sort Out, when you've been covering the albums periodically from, each year in the 60s, that Bob Dylan slowly starts to creep in. And he'd not long done that, was it Sunday Night Play? I always say it wrong, but on the BBC Madhouse on Castle Street. You know, he was becoming a known name, but he wasn't somebody you would immediately think of at that
Kids
point.
Kids wouldn't have, certainly.
No, yes.
It was a reference for people who knew folk music. And he was selling lots lots of albums, but he's definitely not selling them to the 3 and 4 year olds that Magic Roundabout was aimed at.
He may have tried to when he was over his, would you like to buy my...
So, no, that is interesting, because the name changes are one thing, and history has imbued some of these names with perhaps more significance than they have. We'll get on to the legacy and how people have treated it and how they viewed it retrospectively. But it is fascinating. One thing is, it starts in 65, doesn't it? So it starts in the UK in 1965. What I did find in the newspaper archives was there's a bit of a crisis point in kids' TV on the BBC, where it's Doreen Stevens, who was one of the heads of programming.
It may have been Doreen who saw it at the trade fair, actually.
Well, I saw her name in the papers because in the Watch with Mother slot, they were getting rid of the Flowerpot Men and Andy Pandy. And there was this huge outcry, because they were going to be replacing it with these hot new programmes for kids, like Camberwick Green.
That famous fast-moving groovy.
Yeah. But the other thing that was mentioned in the same breath is the Magic Roundabout as being one of the big new things that they were going to offer kids, even though it's in a different time slot. But Andy Pandy and the Flowerpot Men were saved. But there was lots of letters into the papers and the newspapers going out to Doreen Stevens for quotes and things like that. But that's the landscape of kids' TV that the Magic Roundabout comes into. You know, Andy Pandy and the Flowerpot Men are seen, or at that point, as old hat. And here we are in the middle of the 60s going forwards with the Magic Roundabout.
Well, that's interesting, because I think now people would, certainly the Magic Roundabout to an extent, Camberwick Green, would hold that up as kind of a reminder of happier times. Why can't we keep our institutions? But at that point, you know, Andy Pandy was already 15 years old.
Yes.
It would keep on being shown for a quarter of a century. And these shows predated the Suez Crisis. You know, if you look at it in that context, it's ridiculous that shortly into television's existence as a widely available home entertainment option, that people were already crying, saying, why can't things stay the same?
Yeah. But they bring in, so they bring in this thing from France. And what I think is quite nice looking into the history of this is they don't just buy in this thing and then the French have nothing to do with it. It becomes very cooperative, doesn't it, in the way it's made, because they make a lot of episodes of this.
Yes, I think it may even have carried on beyond the point at which ORTF, the French broadcaster, might have persevered with it, because I don't think it even really had. And again, we'll come back to this, the merchandising potential they had over here. But I think they kept making it because there was a steady stream of income from the BBC and, you know, in turn, revenue for merchandise involved.
Yeah, so many episodes. Like, the British series, its first run, runs to something like 441 episodes, which is a ludicrous... I mean, I know they're only 4 or 5 minutes long, but that's a ludicrous amount of work for a stop-motion series, which, if it's to be believed, the people who made it, the Serge Dano and his team, shot it at 24 frames a second, which is more than you need for stop motion. That's a lot of work. It's amazing. But yeah, then they do a movie, which we'll come back to. But it did keep on. It was reborn in the late 80s in France with 250 new episodes. Then you get this UK redubbing or redoing of a few episodes. There's some more episodes in 93. Then you get a little bit of a break, and then the CGI nightmare version of it turns up in the early 21st century.
Interesting how quickly that's been forgotten, because I'm sure more people would think of Nigel playing those early 90s UK redubs before they thought of the film.
Yeah, so there's a film and a series spun off the back of that, and I'm led to believe that we will be getting another new series of the Magic Roundabout, which looks to have gone back to original character designs, or much closer to the original, but it's been delayed quite a bit, it seems.
It has been, because a couple of years ago, I was actually on French radio speaking in French about how it would be received in the UK, and there wasn't an international diplomatic incident, so I must have done okay.
All right, so it could be your fault it's languishing in the archives. But yeah, I believe that's supposedly the new French UK version is Beth Gardner and Jenny Landreth, the writers, and that's Jenny Landreth from Hey Dougie, which is a smash hit, so we shall see what comes of that. So let's have a think then about the vibe. Because I think the reason it lingers in people's memories is because it's got such a unique vibe to it. You know, the types of stories they tell, the type of words that are used in Eric Thompson's storytelling. I mean, how would you describe it?
I would say it's more in line with the sort of art shows you used to get on BBC Two, like arts review shows, than it is with most of the children's television. It's very droll. He intentionally uses, apparently he didn't believe in long words, they were just words. There is a story that Phyllida Law tells about a viewer once wrote to complain that he used too many long words and their children were confused by them, and he wrote back using the longest word he could find in the dictionary, just looking up to see what was long and thinking, how can I use that? basically it's a long-winded way of saying your children are more intelligent than you think.
Yeah.
And, you know, there are a lot of references to current events. There's a lot, apparently, in the 60s ones about joining the EEC, you know, which is obviously a big, how times change, a big flashpoint of national concern around that time. And it's very laid back, very whimsical, but bitingly satirical at the same time. And I think a measure of that would be when we were young, I mean, I still have it now, but we had, amongst all, you know, the usual children's records, Wally White and singing I Know an Old Lady and that sort of thing.
We had that.
We had the BBC Records and Tapes Magic Roundabout album, which it's never been entirely clear, and I love that it's not entirely clear, because I love to have mysteries like that, whether it is just taken with the soundtracks of the episodes, or whether Eric Thompson re-recorded them in the studio, because sometimes they did that and sometimes they didn't on BBC Records, which is interesting. I did not regard that as one of the children's records that we had. I saw it more like the records that my parents still had around, like Rotated Discs with Unwin, the Stanley Unwin record and Beyond the Fringe album. To me, it was like a funny album. And I can still almost recite along with it those stories in full. Mr. McHenry was worried about his heliotropes.
Yeah. I mean, this is an interesting thing, because you were talking about the time slot it was in. And so it was to its benefit, because it was just before the news, which meant you already had people sitting down, grown-ups sitting down for the news, and they saw this as well. And that really captured people's imaginations. It reminded me a bit about the stories about Do Not Adjust Your Set, people rushing home from work to watch this ostensibly a kids' show thing. And then there was the big outcry when they moved it in the schedules, which is an amazing thing, to the point where, is it Late Night Review with Joan Bakewell? They've got Serge Dano on, and they opened this little thing with Joan Bakewell, and they've got the letters of all these adults that have been sent into the BBC saying, please move it back, because a group of children, you know, 20 office workers, want to watch the Magic Roundabout. So it clearly had a very quick impact, given it had only started in 1965. But I was watching one of the slightly later ones, which is Dougal Film Director, and looking for the references. That is a kid's story, a 4 minutes kid's story. Dougal sticks a camera on the back of Brian the Snail, and ostensibly they try to make a film. They don't. It's barely a story at all. But it has references to unions. It starts out with talking about unions. It has references to a Broadway adaptation of a Christopher Isherwood book called I Am a Camera. The director Antonioni, or Antonioni-oni-oni-i, as he's referred to in the episode. Ben-Hur, Ken Russell, Eisenstein. These are not kids' references.
No.
Even if you're a kid, like a three-year-old watching it in 1965, I don't think you'd still know it in 1972. You'd know who... It's like, are you watching Battleship Potemkin again? it's amazing, really, what they fitted in there.
Yes, it really, really is. I mean, in some ways, you can look at it as... It's very odd to say it was a product of the 60s, because it had that odd dual heritage, and, you know, somebody who, if Eric Thompson was switched on, he was during the jazz era, you know, associating more with Dave Brubeck or something than the Beatles. I'm sure the Beatles loved the Magic Roundabout, though. Although I did look, I don't think they've ever commented on it, but it's still got that momentum of the fact that across, well, popular culture, but culture in general, things start to change very, very quickly in the 60s.
Yes.
And when I say very quickly, you know, from one thing to another, it doesn't, the perception is always, you know, it goes to hippies and psychedelia and then it's the Vietnam War. But if you look at the UK, I would say the best barometer is, if you look at even more than, we all know the story of the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, if you look at Rod Stewart, he spends the whole of the 60s jumping on every bandwagon possible to try and become famous. You know, he has spells as a mod, as a folkie, he's involved with CND at one point, he does R&B, and it was like an explosion of awareness, because, you know, in some ways that's when the mass media comes into its own in the 60s. And I think the Magic Roundabout, as you say, incorporating references like that, is a product of that.
And it's got a wonderful pop art feel to it. It ties into psychedelic design as well. And this is, again, we'll talk about people's perception of it being drug inspired, which obviously we'll deal with that in a bit, but it's got a beautiful look to it that ties in nicely. So it ties in sort of the ages of people experiencing these, the burgeoning weird 60s of 65, 66, 67, etc. So that's really, really interesting. We should talk about the fact, though, that there was a film, which I warned you in advance of this, I only watched 2 days ago for the first time ever, Dougal and the Blue Cat. What was going on with that?
It is very difficult to say. I remember, actually, when Nigel Planer did his Magic Roundabout, there was an interview where somebody asked him, what's going on with Dougal and the Blue Cat? And he said, it's anyone's guess, really. Basically, it's a feature-length story where if people want to see the Magic Roundabout, some kind of, you know, jolly, fun, psychedelic trip, this is the bad trip.
Yes.
This is everyone in the Magic Garden follows, and I say a sinister blue cat, but he's got a sort of John Prescott voice.
Well, it's quite funny because the cat's called Buxton.
Buxton,
yeah. Which is a family name in my family. So it's like, it's very weird that the antagonist, or one of the antagonists in that film, is called Buxton, and he's just got this voice from somewhere up north. That was odd. There's lots of very funny references in there.
Yeah, Dougal's the only one who mistrusts him, and everyone says, oh, he can't be bad. He's nice, and he's a cat. And Buxton has ambitions, where it's not quite clear what he will achieve from them beyond being king of what appears to be not the Magic Garden.
Yeah.
But he has to go through, a mysterious blue voice guides him through a series of trials, and Buxton actually gets frightened during it. It's not a comforting film for children at all.
No, so he has to go through 7 doors to complete these trials, and the first thing that happens is, it's basically, if you don't succeed on any of these trials, you're going to get shot by a sword that's flung at you from a medieval, like, crossbow baluster thing. It's terrifying. He's pursued by terrifying medieval weaponry in order to force him to remember the name 7 different shades of blue in order to get through these doors. But the blue thing, we should mention that. This is definitely a post-Yellow Submarine film.
Absolutely.
Because the baddies want to take over the world by turning everything blue. In this case, all the lettuces are turned blue. Blue cactuses. It doesn't explain it, other than essentially blue not really existing in nature that much. Suddenly flowers are turning blue. But I don't really get the end game of it, except that there is this voice. That's the thing that creeped me out, the disembodied voice.
And do you know who it is?
I do.
Fenella Fielding, who you would not normally associate with a, you know, frightening voice.
No.
Not even in Carry On Screaming.
I mean, it's an inspired choice to be the only other voice that's ever heard in Magic Roundabout beyond Eric Thompson's. But it's very creepy, this disembodied voice who's driving this poor cat on to become the king of the world so she can then become queen of the universe or whatever it is. The scale of her evil scope is terrifying. It involves sending Dougal and the blue cat to the moon. And it's post-moon landing at this point, so you get all the references and things like that. It's an absolutely nuts film, this.
Well, I think what's telling is that it wasn't available for a long time. It did get released to cinemas in the early 70s. Mm-hmm. And then I'm not sure it was ever shown on television during the 70s and 80s. I've searched for records of it and not found any. There was a video release in the 80s on Channel 5. It basically released everything on video in the 80s. And yes, I had that. I can't remember how I got hold of it, but I did have that. And then there was a later, I think, more cleaned up release. I can't remember who by, in the 90s, where it was the era Cult TV magazine and so on. So it was a bit more, have you seen this? It's weird.
Yes.
But there is a lot of reference to, you know, Mark Kermode, the film critic, has a number of films he keeps going on about, had a huge influence on him when he was young, like Slade in Flame and Jeremy.
Yes,
but
yes.
One was Dougal and the Blue Cat, and he does talk a lot about the memory of it, and, you know, the not having seen it since he saw it in the cinema, and that it was exactly the same when he did later see it. So it did disappear for a while, and it could just be entirely innocent reasons. It could just be there were rights issues, or people just forgot about it, or there were no decent prints that didn't look like they were decaying in real time, but it did seem to disappear for a while.
I did see online, I think the current rights holder has scanned and restored it in 4K. They haven't released it. They have it listed on their website as a thing we own. Are you interested in this film? Fill out a web form. So presumably if 50,000, 100,000 people filled in this web form, that this company would release it. But I don't know. It's very frustrating to think it's sat there somewhere scanned in, and cleaned up in 4K. Now is the time. Bring back Dougal and the Blue Cat. All right, so here's another word. Legacy. Let's talk about, as I've hinted at, the way it's perceived, or it got perceived later, with music and drugs and all that stuff.
Well, I think what I would hinge my response to all of that around, in terms of the fact that I think it accidentally chimed with some of the things, but I don't think it did until later on. I don't think, you know, Roy Wood was going around in 1966 saying he'd seen that Magic Roundabout, mind-blowing. And there are very few references at that point in popular culture to the Magic Roundabout. There's not even really any songs about it. There's a couple of bands in the late 60s, early 70s did songs called Magic Garden, but they don't appear to be about the Magic Roundabout.
Yeah, yeah.
You get more, this is a perpetual hobby horse of mine, but shall we mention earlier, you get more, as far as I'm concerned, are direct lifts from music from Campbell-Witt Green in pop music around that time, which, you know, was folky,
yeah, yeah,
rolling guitar riffs that people might have picked up on, you know, while they were idling away time waiting for the next 2-hour session at Abbey Road or whatever. But what is interesting is one of the animators who worked on it initially in France was a British guy called Ivor Wood, who later went on to make all kinds of shows that went in that same time slot, actually, like The Wombles, Paddington, Simon and the Land of Chalk Drawings. When he came back in 1968 to the UK, he sold a series called The Herbs, which is a little bit overlooked now to the BBC. Mm-hmm. That was his first sort of solo animation, which is, it's got some similarities to the Magic Roundabout, but it's like the sort of British psychedelic pop of the time. It's quite Sergeant Peppery, you know, it's in the sort of Victorian wall herb garden.
Yes, yeah.
And the characters are very, they might have stepped out of early Pink Floyd lyrics. You know, that is something that I think it was just what was in the air, rather than he sat down and thought, I'll make a show for the heads to get into. And I think people, because it chimed with some of their interests later on, retrospectively, and it's so hard to shake people, it's so hard to get them to give up these notions they've built into their heads, like the whole thing about there were rude names and Captain Pugwash. There weren't, but because it suits them to believe it, they refuse to stop believing it. But obviously people then start saying the Magic Roundabout was all a big coded message about how great it was to take drugs. And having seen Serge Dano in conversation, yeah, I'm not sure he was frying his brains in his spare time.
No, people's perpetual sort of way of looking at the 60s is that everything was drugs. The fact that people are still going, no, it doesn't matter what Lennon said. Lucy in the Sky with Diamonds, it's all about LSD. It is. It doesn't matter what he says and all the evidence they've got. It is, isn't it? It's like, get over it. People have imaginations. But, I mean, the drug culture of the early 90s, rave, certainly took some influence from the music of it, from the steam-powered pipe organ roundabout music, didn't it?
Yeah, I mean, just off the top of my head, there was an actual hit single, Summer's Magic, by Mark Summers, which he was a dance DJ who, apparently, he's just got fed up of every record that was made having, you know, American samples on it. So he built one out of bits of things like It's That Man Again and so on, but he based it around the theme for the Magic Roundabout, and that was a hit. I really loved that. And there was a record by a dance outfit called Magic Roundabout, Everlasting Day it was called, where it's odd this has been forgotten about. It was Magic with a K, presumably, so they didn't have to pay any royalties to anyone. Mm-hmm. There was a rumour at the time that was one or both the KLF with Jason Donovan on vocals. It does sound a bit like Jason Donovan. Ooh. And it's surprising that, looking back, I don't think it was, because somebody would have made more of it retrospectively, but it's surprising it's disappeared, given that, you know, it had that attached to it. There was a band called Sed Florence who were a bit, they used to play, I think, with Blur quite early on, who were, you know, that kind of like 60s guitar trippy. Are you aware of the Chilling Crew?
I am not aware of the Chilling Crew. It's a very hot day today. I don't know where the Chilling Crew are. They're not doing a very good job.
Well, they were Woodlands Animations, you know, the people who did Postman Pat,
yes,
and
yeah.
so forth. Tried to create a stop-motion UK hip-hop gang called the Chilling Crew, who were all children, but their one record, Too Much Fun, sampled the Magic Roundabout theme and Zebedee's Boing.
Oh, gosh, yeah. I saw a couple more that were on here. Magic Style, a roundabout mix by The Bad Man, and Moon Stomping by Undercover Movement all sample the theme from Magic Roundabout. So I'm sure you're all digging out your copies of those records. It's a funny one, isn't it? The adoption of it onto Channel 4 and the sort of looking back at it sort of with a certain amount of irony. And it really doesn't need to be looked at ironically. And that's the funny thing, despite us talking about its own sort of internal silliness, its referencing, its sort of postmodernism in and of itself, it's not something to look at cynically. It's very purely silly and clever on its own terms, without any cynicism.
Yeah, and that's why I would recommend, I mean, the Nigel Planer episode's come in for a bit of stick now, but I think he did. He made a decent effort on a difficult job. And he didn't just try to copy Eric Thompson, he tried to put his own spin on it. And even if those episodes don't quite work, he did do two things to tie in with it, which I think are worth more exposure, because they do sort of hold some of those retrospective, those legacy opinions to account, really. He did a spoof documentary called The Return of the Magic Roundabout, which I think went out on Christmas Day morning on Channel 4.
All right.
Where he actually interviewed Mark Summers about Summers' magic in it, but in the sort of, the whole thing is that because he's bringing back the Magic Roundabout, he knows too much, and all kinds of weird ancient hippies and, you know, French right-wing politicians are hunting him down. It's a genuinely funny spoof documentary, but he also wrote a book called Zen and the Magic of Roundabout Maintenance, which was clearly because, you know, Nigel Planer was of that, the tail end, but, you know, of that hippie generation. And the book is a send-up of, you know, those hippie self-help texts from the 70s.
Yeah, yeah.
about, you know, what did the Magic Roundabout characters do when the show wasn't in production? Well, they went into guruism, apart from Dougal, who became a sort of proto-yuppie type and privatised the bird songs in the garden. But it's much funnier than making it sound, because you can tell Nigel Planer is good at sending up that kind of mindset. You know, well, I mean, Neil, obviously, from The Young Ones, is a great character.
Yes.
Yeah. And if you ever enjoyed Neil, you will love this book.
Fantastic. Oh, that's brilliant.
I think it's very easy to underestimate just how huge it was, because yeah. I can think of, you know, we had so, admittedly from a large family, but we had so many Magic Roundabout things. I have still got the Dougal pillowcase that I think was passed down between a few of us. I've still got a Pelham Puppets Dougal that we had, but we had all kinds of things, you know, like Magic Roundabout lampshades and so on. It was everywhere. I was furiously envious of some kids down the road who had, because Corgi did a load of Magic Roundabout cars and so on, but one of them had Mr. Rusty with his barrel organ, but when you wound the handle, it played the Magic Roundabout theme on, you know, one of those music box things, yeah. And Zebedee popped out. And if you look for that on eBay now, they're about 150 quid in sort Blimey. Of working order. It was absolutely huge, and it was the mainstay, I think, of that slot just before the news, which didn't go on for as long as people think, because it starts with, I think they showed Hergé's Adventures of Tintin just yeah. before the Magic Roundabout, so about 64, early 65, and then it only goes on until about 1984, because that's when the BBC changed the news to 60 Minutes, which is
yes.
one of my favourite bizarre deviations they did for no reason that didn't work, where the whole news was unified, you know, including all your regional news. So there was no more slot before the news. Well, there was, but it was 25 minutes, so they put things like Charles in Charge, the sitcom, in there.
Yeah,
and then
yeah.
even they got usurped by Neighbours. But, you know, you had things like the Magic Roundabout Clangers, Captain Pugwash, and they brought about Willow the Wisp. They all had that sort of whimsy to them, that, but weren't copying each other. It was a different edge, a different tone, a different style of irreverent humour. And it was one that you didn't really get, certainly anywhere else in the children's schedules, but maybe anywhere else in the schedules full stop.
Yeah, it's funny, because it's not attempting to reflect anything about kids, which a lot of later sort of kids' TV does. It says, who's our audience? How do we reflect them? You think about the ones you've just named there. These are all things that take place out in the open. You know, they're not even in cities particularly. Florence goes to the Magic Roundabout in order to go to a magic garden. Captain Pugwash is out at sea. Will-o'-the-Wisp is in a mysterious wood. All that sort of stuff. These are fantastical things to enjoy. Storytelling set in different places. That's not to denigrate any of the brilliant storytelling that you get in some of these ones that are set in schools and things like that. But it is nice to have that ultimate escapism and for them to be funny as well.
And I would also say, irrespective of any other legacy it's had, I think the legacy it should have is, it was the sort of happy accident that could only have happened at the BBC.
Yeah.
You know, only through those circumstances, only through being forced to think of a creative way round something where you didn't have the money or the resources, even though you were, you know, the national broadcaster. Admittedly, you get less things like that happening now at the BBC, but you still do. And I think that's why we need the BBC. And really, we should be using Dylan as a big sort of poster boy image of why the BBC is important, because it gives us things like this, which yeah. we're still talking about. It started before either of us were born.
Yeah.
And here
yeah.
we are still talking about it incredibly enthusiastically now. And if you look at, you know, Eric Thompson was lured away by ITV. He did The Magic Ball in 1970, repeated well into the 80s. Who remembers that now?
No one.
And also, ITV leapt on Serge Dano's next show, which I think was called Le Poustouf, which they got Eric Thompson to narrate it. They paid a stupid amount of money for it, you know, anticipating huge merchandising sales. And in the end, they just didn't show it.
Did it have an English title that ever emerged?
I don't think so.
Weird.
That's it didn't even get that far. There were newspapers saying ITV in shock bid for show by Magic Roundabout creator. And then it's mysteriously quiet after that.
Well, that's very strange. Anyway, that leaves Magic Roundabout clear for its domination. Brilliant. Okay, so this is a point in the show, Tim, normally, where you'd ask someone to plug stuff. But this is your show, so are you allowed to do that? Or will it create some sort of infinite recursion plug loop?
Well, given that I've just been picking up the BBC, I shouldn't be advertising. But
oh, yeah, that's true.
I will say, I mean, I'll be surprised if anyone listening to this doesn't know that if you go to timworthington.org, you'll find all kinds of things like my ongoing series of series-by-series Doctor Who reviews, features on all kinds of similar programmes like The Clangers and so on. But also, quite a few tie-ins with the Golden Age of Children's TV, including a conversation I had with Andy Miller from the Backlisted podcast, which is up on there. And I would really, if you've enjoyed the book, I really recommend having a listen to that. So I would recommend having a listen to that. And yeah, please just keep up the good work. That means listening to Looks Unfamiliar generally. But given that we're talking about a programme from 1965, I think, Paul, you should be plugging something that you're doing.
Well, we are currently running towards the end of the 60s. In fact, in our podcast, the Big Beatles and 60s Sort Out, where we've been looking at every UK number one of the 1960s. And boy, it's been a long road. But we're in 1969 now. But those episodes are all there to listen to if you're into things from the 60s. And you can then tell my brother why he's ranked something too high or too low. Luckily, I don't have to come up with the numbers. But it's a ranking podcast. And we've enjoyed traipsing our way through the 60s. It's been very interesting.
That's all from the Golden Age of Children's TV for this time. If you enjoyed what you've heard and want to know more, why not head for timworthington.org? Or alternately, just head for your nearest bookshop. And if they don't have it in stock, then why not send out Fancy and Choo Choo in a big coat to swipe a copy while the bookseller isn't looking?